They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:16 Wednesday, August 3rd. I remember to change my calendar behind me. And I'm Joe Bianca, the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I want to wish a very sincere happy birthday to our sensei, our producer, Patty Wolf. What are you shaking your head for, John?
In the beginning, that was going to be my intro. I had
all three of my intros. Well, that's how much
true.
We love Patty.
That's true.
But now puts a lot of pressure on Bill to do it too.
You know, sparkly, candles and in light of Patty's birthday and everything. So anyway, Bill, I'm gonna jump in because my candle's gonna burn pretty soon. But Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable, I want to welcome Joe Bianca back from his vacation. Remind everybody that we have our 150th show coming up in a couple of weeks, so we're going to have some great guests on that. And also to wish happy birthday to Patty. And now Bill will sing happy birthday.
Good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for Thoroughbred Daily News, and I can't sing to save my life, so I will not be doing that. And without being able, you guys have already decided I can't say happy birthday to Patty. So I got
you don't want to talk trade deadline? How the Red Sox have reanimated their...
Don't remind me. It was a disaster for our team.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. This November, Keeneland is the place to be as the home of the Breeders' Cup World Championships, followed directly by the November Breeding Stock Sale. You can learn more at november.keeneland.com. Okay, so it's good to be back in the captain's chair this week. Missed you guys last week. Did a great job, as always, without me. And we have some good racing to talk about, mainly at Saratoga from the weekend. And I think the headliner for me, you know, as great as Jackie's Warrior was, and it's you know, always fun to watch him and always a pleasure to talk about him. The headliner to me was Epicenter in the Jim Dandy, because this was one of those races that, you know, wasn't long on number of horses, but was long on talent. You had three of the top three-year-olds in the country and him early voting and Zandan. And Epicenter basically blew them away. And I was surprised. I don't know about you guys, but I was surprised and how the race unfolded, because I expected Epicenter from the inside post, especially after what happened in the Preakness with him being too far back. I expected Joel Rosario to be aggressive and send him to the lead and for early voting to be stalking him, but it didn't work out that way. Early voting got the trip of a lifetime, and I thought was the real big disappointment in there. I thought Zandon ran a pretty good race, but Epicenter in the stretch really had those horses anytime he wanted. And it's interesting what's happened like in the past 2 weeks, because I didn't get to talk to you guys about the Haskell last week. But we went from Jack Christopher being what we thought was the top three-year-old in the land to now, you know, he's still obviously a really nice horse, but you got to think his future is one turn. To now Epicenter, I think, is once again the top three-year-old in the country. And we felt that way earlier in the year leading up to the Derby. And he got lost in the sauce a little bit when he ran second in the Derby in the Preakness. So we hadn't seen him since. To me, it's clear now that he's the top three-year-old in the country. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, a couple things looking back, how unlucky was this horse not to have won a Triple Crown race? I mean, he and it, the circumstances played differently, easily could have won both the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness. And yeah, I picked Epicenter, big deal. I pick a favorite in a four horse race. But, you know, a 16th of a mile, an 8th of a mile into the race, this horse had no chance. And it didn't make any sense. And one of the reasons I picked him was I thought, because he's going to go to the lead. Yeah. He's going to dictate the pace because he has enough speed to do that. And he drew inside of early voting. And, you know, I don't know if that was it was never really, so far as I saw, really explained by Joel Rosario or Steve Asmussen, if that was the plan to take him from off the pace or that's just sort of the way things developed. But I thought, oh, you know, after Rosario didn't give him a great ride in the Preakness, he said, oh, God, what is Joel doing here? This horse is not going to win. For him to have overcome, you know, it wasn't a terrible trip by any stretch of the imagination, but it was a trip where he was the one that was at a disadvantage. And for him to have overcome that and then to win quite easily over, like you said, two very good horses in early voting in Zandon, you know, really stamped him as the horse to beat in the Travers, number one, and number two, the best three-year-old out there. Now, the Travers is going to get more difficult, mainly because, you know, what is Chargett all about? We don't know. You know, coming off that ridiculous win in the Dwyer. But yeah, a very good performance for him. And I have plenty to say about Jackie's Warrior, but I'll let John go and then I'll circle back to that.
Yeah. And for me, there were really three stories over the weekend. One is, you know, Epicenter, obviously, and just how well he ran and how he has, you know, brought himself back to the prominence of a 3-year-old crop. Also, really disappointed in early voting. You know, when a horse can go out there in 24-1, 48-112, very, very pedestrian, you know, fractions for a grade two Jim Dandy, especially on a speed favoring racetrack like Saratoga has been playing this summer. I was really shocked that that he packed it in as quickly as he did. Epicenter went by everybody and you know, sat off the speed, and he went down the middle of the racetrack and won very impressively. But let's also give due to the trainer, Steve Asmussen, where not only did he win the Jim Dandy, he won the Vanderbilt, and he also won the Amsterdam. I mean, we talked about, Joe, you weren't here last week, but we were crowing about how great of a weekend it was for Chad Brown to come in to Monmouth and invade and win all those graded stake races that he did. You know, not to take anything away from Monmouth, but I think we'll all agree Saratoga is a much deeper pool to win races in. And, you know, Steve Asmussen and his team won the Jim Dandy, the Vanderbilt, and the Amsterdam. To me, that is a story unto itself. We'll talk about Jackie's Warrior because, as far as I'm concerned, that race, Jackie's Warrior's race, was the race where you go, wow. And granted, he was, you know, 1-5. I mean, that's the way he's supposed to win a race. But how awesome is that horse? And just setting up for the Jack versus Jack, or Jack versus Jackie, you know, sprint Breeders' Cup race. I mean, that is going to be like an Ollie Frazier type race. It's really going to be exciting to see those two heavyweights run for the Breeders' Cup for all the money for the title of championship sprinter. So for me, it was Epicenter, Jackie's Warrior, and Asmussen et al. On his team. They all deserve you know, kudos for this weekend's performances.
Are we sure that Jack Christopher is going to be pointed to the sprint? Because
nobody said as much, Joe. I think they've only committed to the Alan Jerkins. But, you know, what other option would they have? I mean, if the Breeders' Cup dirt mile around one turn, I think that would be a major option. But around two turns, I don't know that – and this is just me saying this. I don't think that's what they would go for. I would assume, yes, he's going to go for the sprint.
Yeah, I've seen horses that I thought were going to go in a sprint before instead opt for the somewhat easier spot in the dirt mile. But yeah, I mean, I obviously would love to see that matchup. Jackie's Warrior is just, he's so devastating every single time he runs. And listen, people are going to complain that wasn't a legitimate grade one field. But that's what happens when you have a horse who is so dominant the way he is. You're going to scare away the competition. And that was the easiest grade one win you'll ever see in your life. You know, he just galloped around the track, and I was saying on Twitter, I remember the last time I seen a grade one without the jockey moving his hands once, and someone corrected me, and they said, Joel did move his hands once to tip him outside. Just a little nudge to tip him outside of the pace setter early on, and that was all it took. He did everything else himself. It was the definition of a public workout, and it's great to watch him, and I always shout him out, but I got to shout out Kirk Robinson and Judy Robinson for bringing him back as a four-year-old, because we complain a lot on this show about horses getting retired after the three-year-old season. And, you know, they run four times and they're whisked off to the breeding shed. Got to give credit when the opposite happens and the owners and the connections bring a horse back who everybody loves to see, bring a champion back and, you know, have him strut his stuff in front of the Saratoga grandstand. It was a real special performance and a 105 buyer. So, I mean, in general, I don't love when people say, well, this horse could have won by so much more. Well, you don't know that. In this case, this horse obviously could have won by so much more than that. Could have gotten a 10-plus buyer and won by 6-7 lengths if he wanted to. And, you know, he's probably going to win the four-go. And the question now becomes, you know, how legitimate of a horse of the year candidate is he? And there was some discussion about that on Twitter after the race. And, you know, I think a lot depends. We got the Whitney coming up this Saturday that we're going to preview later. A lot of it depends who wins that race, how impressively, what that horse does the rest of the year. But I would say right now, at this moment, on August 3rd, Jackie's Warrior's got the most impressive resume of any horse in the country right now to be horse of the year. I'm curious to hear what you guys say about that. But I just wanted to mention the Amsterdam real quick, too, because John talked about what a big weekend it was for Steve Asmussen. Gunite is a little bit of an underappreciated horse, I think. He had a really nice two-year-old season, fell off a little bit later in the year, and then early this year, last race, he had a second that I thought, you know, he was a little bit better than it looked. I thought Accretive ran a really good race, too, for Chad Brown. I think he's a really nice horse. We'll probably see those two in the Alan Jerkins again. Corniche was a big disappointment. Apparently, he tore his frog off in that race, so he's going to need some recovery from that. He just sort of a ridiculous underlay. No matter what, So he's the kind of horse who needs to kind of regain some of that past magic, and we'll see if he can ever do it. But yeah, I just wanted to mention Gunite too, because he's super game. That was, you know, I thought the Chad horse was going to run by him for basically the entire last furlong, and he couldn't do it. So shout out to Gunite and Gunrunner, obviously still producing these monster horses. But what do you guys think about Jackie's Warrior? Do you think he has a legitimate horse of the year chance?
Yeah, I mean, a couple points. I'll start with that. For what it's worth, in the NTRA poll, I'm a voter. I voted for him second this week behind Flightline. He'll need Flightline and maybe a couple others in the divisions that normally voters look to first for Horse of the Year to, you know, stub their toes at some point. And, you know, you can, if you want to say, you know, Flightline is what, going to run 2.5 times this year or whatever, that isn't enough to be Horse of the Year. You might have a legitimate argument, though. So we'll see. But, you know, Joe, you're right. I can't recall any race at that level where a horse has won that easily. I realize, you know, the horses behind him weren't great, but they weren't bums either. And, you know, it reminded me, you know, we always talk about XBTV as one of our sponsors here. If someone showed you that video and you didn't understand there was a race, it looked like those workouts in what they do. But then when they go 5 furlongs and 103, you know, and you say, oh, of course he went. So because the jockey never, or the exercise rider never allowed him to run, you know, it looked exactly like a morning workout, but they put a morning workout in 109 and change that earned a 105 buyer. I mean, it was an absolutely sensational race on his part. And yeah, I mean, if the racing season ended today, would I vote for Horse of the Year? You know, maybe I would, but you know, we're going to have to see what happens throughout the rest of the year. But yeah, it's great to have this horse back. And I think when it's all said and done, this might be the race from Sarah, depending on what happens in the Whitney and Travers, of course, but this might be the most memorable, turn out to be the most memorable race of the meet.
Let me just give you a hypothetical that probably won't happen, but let's just play it out. Let's say that Nest runs in the Travers and wins. And then Ness runs in the Distaff and wins. Based on her resume with those two wins, you know, win against the boys in the Travers, second in the Belmont, a win in the coaching club, second in the Oaks, and winning the Ashland, all and the Suncoast, and you know, all in the calendar year of 2022.
The Suncoast.
Don't forget that, because she beat us. So that's why I remember it. But, you know, at that point in time, does that give Nest the resume to be Horse of the Year? If she beats the boys, you know, finish second in the Belmont and then wins the Travers and then beats all the girls in the Distaff, wouldn't that make a compelling argument for her as well?
Well, John, I've been texting Mike Rapoli back and forth. He said, quote unquote, it's very unlikely she goes in the Travers. So, and yeah, but I mean, you know, a lot of hypotheticals there. I mean, but I just wanted to interject that.
Yeah, no, that's tough. Maybe when he hears this podcast, he'll realize that if she has an inside track to be Horse of the Year, then, you know, he'll run her against the boys again. But, you know, I think at this point, because it's August 3rd, we're all making hypothetical assumptions. You know, if these horses continue to do well, it's really, as we all know, it's really going to come down to the race records and what they do in October and November, quite frankly, because they're all so close. To me, and I think this discussion is exactly, you know, why we're talking about it, there's no real clear-cut horse, but certainly whoever wins their respective division in the Breeders' Cup race and the prep is most likely going to be on the ballot for the top three, and then we'll see at that. But it's interesting. There's no clear-cut horse. It's not like we're sitting here saying, you know, Rich Strike, because he won the Derby, is going to be Horse of the Year if he does well, or Epicenter if he wins the, you know, another race, is going to be horse. There's a lot of horses right now, as of the first week of August, that could be Horse of the Year. And quite frankly, this is when, you know, the champions are made, is in the fall.
You know, it's interesting. You had the racing manager, John, trying to put Nest in the Travers and then having her win the Distaff. And then we had the reporter, Bill, interrupt and say, no, John, Mike Rapoli says he's probably not going to do that. See, that's why this show is successful. We have three different personalities and three different skill sets that really bounce off each other. But yeah, it's definitely not going to be one of those years where Bricks and Mortar wins Horse of the Year by default. And no disrespect to Bricks and Mortar, but we've had years like that before where it's like, God, do we really have to pick a Horse of the Year this year? This year, I think there's going to be, you know, probably at least 3 or 4 different horses that you could make a strong, strong case for. And we're looking forward to the Whitney and also seeing Flightline in the Pacific Classic try to make their cases. But So I wanted to mention this also from the weekend, because we had a couple of different rising stars. We had three of them, two at Del Mar and one at Saratoga. The ones at Del Mar were Newgate for Bob Baffert and Justique for John Sheriffs. And then at Saratoga, I think I said Belmont, at Saratoga, we had Prank, who's a daughter of Into Mischief. And I thought of the three of them, Prank was very clearly the most impressive one. And she was touted by her work tab too, and you know, was bet down to 4 to 5 and 1 to 2, actually, I think, in what looked like a pretty live race, and just completely obliterated that field for Todd Pletcher. And I think that she, you know, if you had to pick right now, she would be the favorite for the spin away. Obviously, there's some time left and some two-year-old to come out after the rest of the meet. But it leads to an interesting discussion, and we've had this question asked of us before, of what makes a rising star? And, you know, it's become a pretty big thing in the industry for TDNs, rising stars. A lot of people, you know, they advertise based on horses who are rising stars. And, you know, I've said this before, but there's no set criteria, really. Like there's no necessary checklist that we go through. And it's really just more of a pros and cons type thing. And I think especially this time of year, we get a lot more rising stars because we tend to lean more towards the two-year-olds and the more lightly raced horses. Whereas if you're debuting a three-year-old in August or September, you know, the horse could be super impressive first out, but I think in general, it's not a great sign when horses debut that late. So the horse has to really do something special to get that designation if they're debuting like any later than, you know, I would say March or April of their three-year-old season. The other things we focus on are the quality of the field. Obviously, with two-year-olds, that's sometimes tough to gauge because they haven't run before. But you can get a sense if you read the Clocker reports and you look at the trainers and the connections in the race and the purchase prices. You can get a sense of what are live-looking two-year-old races. The other thing is, you know, win margin, time, in terms of whether or not they shook off pace pressure or came from off the pace with traffic trouble. Those are really the kind of things we look for. And you know, it's tough to gauge, like I said, sometimes because you don't know what the competition is and you don't know what's behind the horse all the time. But I think in general, sometimes it just pops. And sometimes it's a debate. Sometimes they're no-brainers. Like Prank was a no-brainer. There was no way we were not going to make that horse a rising star. By Into Mischief, Todd Pletcher, touted with the works, ran off to a big win, stopped the clock in under 1:10. So we'd be morons not to make that horse a rising star. But then there are other ones that are a little more murky and tough to figure out. But you know, I wonder from an outside perspective, since you guys aren't part of that process, I know Bill's complained about some rising stars not made in the past, but you have, Bill. I remember it. I remember the discussion in the office. But like, what do you guys think it should be like the most weighted characteristics when it comes to conversations like that?
Well, Joe, I think you touched on all of them, and you know, it is, there's a lot of objectivity to that, but I want to kind of twist this in another direction. Obviously, one thing you don't take into account is a buyer number. And, right. You know, right now in horse racing, the buyer numbers are just religious zealots when it comes to the numbers. And, you know, it's interesting because this is now from among those three horses, there's a very interesting scenario and a debate now with Justique. Now, everything you said, if I were doing the rising stars, yeah, I would have made her a rising star because she was so visually impressive in the race. You know, trained by John Sheriffs, you know, probably, you know, not probably, John Sheriffs, no way she was cranked up to go in a 5.5 furlong race. And she, you know, closed from last and won so easily, but she got a 72 buyer number. So, you know, what do you do with a horse like that? That you know, that's not a number that makes her, a future star. You know, the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Filly is what that race would usually go in the low 90s or something like that, to the best of my recollection. So, you know, it's interesting. We're going to find out, you know, how relevant those numbers were. And I do find that I think the hardest numbers to make are the ones that are the worst harbingers of future success are two-year-old maiden races. I think it's very hard for them to make the numbers. And I've seen plenty of horses that broke their maidens impressively, did not get good numbers, and came back and were successful. So I think this horse will be fine. But, you know, I think in some respects, it's good that you don't take those numbers into account, Because if you did, it'd just be, okay, this horse, two-year-old, first-time starter, you know, paid $28 and is trained by, you know, a second-tier trainer. Oh, but he got a 90 buyer number. You will make it a rising star. So, you know, I just thought that was sort of an interesting twist on this because, you know, how good is Justique? Well, right now, from the buyer number, not a superstar. Other factors tell you otherwise.
And because the process is subjective, it's a little difficult to like quantify it. And I know you guys have to use the eye test as probably the most prominent thing. Because if it was just based on breeding, then you wouldn't have a majority of horses even eligible for it, you know, to be a rising star. And if it was just horses that were like with super trainers, again, you would carve out the majority of horses that run on a day-to-day basis. So I know that the process has to be difficult for you guys as far as, you know, trying to spotlight who the up and comers are, because really the rising star in, you know, in essence is you're trying to project a horse that's going to continue to do well. It's not just this horse ran really well going 5/8 of a mile, or this horse won really impressively going 5.5. I think, I don't put words in your mouth, Joe, but I think the whole premise of the rising star is that these are horses that we feel have a promising future going further in their career and going longer, hopefully in distance. And I think that's why some of the pedigrees get discounted immediately and some of the racetracks get discounted immediately. Like, I don't remember the last time there was a rising star at Woodbine or some of the other smaller racetracks, for example, that may have had impressive winners. But, you know, the field competition wasn't as good, or the time wasn't as good, or they're kind of from a, you know, they were a $5,000 yearling purchase. So I think all those factors kind of go into it. I would love to see it if it was more blind in the sense of, you know, you don't look at pedigree, you don't look at where the horse is coming from. But I think that's impossible because we all know all the information and that's not realistic. You know, the thing with Justique that I thought was most impressive was the way that she came down the lane. And, you know, Espinosa really not only didn't move his hands, but at the end, there's a picture that will show at the end when the horse hits the wire, he actually accidentally drops the whip. And it almost looks like it's a mic drop. Like, yep, that was it. You know, end of story. I don't need to say anything else because she was so good. But this weekend in particular, I thought it was really interesting that, you know, normally for two-year-old races, if a horse has experience, they usually have an advantage over the other horses. In Justique's race, the top three finishers were all first-time starters. In Prank's race, the top six finishers were first-time starters. So what you're seeing now is some of these programs unleashing their top two-year-olds and unleashing, you know, the dragons in their groups. And to me, that's going to be really exciting, and it's going to be an opportunity for you guys to identify more rising stars. I can't argue with you on Prank and Newgate and Justique, and I think Capture the Flag also, the first time star.
Yeah. And I forgot one too on Sunday, that the Muharrar horse, Be Your Best.
Be Your Best of Horacio De Paz on the turf. Yeah. So there were five horses there, and you know, Be Your Best actually was the one I was going to mention because she's a filly that didn't have any of those boxes checked. She's not from a big outfit. She's not from a big super trainer. She's not well bred. She wasn't an expensive horse, and she ran on the turf, you know. So she really did above and beyond to go ahead and get the mantle of a rising star. But I thought Capture the Flag was an interesting one also because, again, Bill, to your point, you know, that's a colt, quality road colt that ran a 61 buyer, which is not great, but first time starter should go longer and trained by Shug McGahee, who we all know doesn't, you know, crank. We talk about John Sheriff's not cranking on these horses. You know, Shug doesn't even crank on them as a 3-year-old, let alone as a 2-year-old first time out. So, you know, there were five really good candidates, I think, for this weekend that were going in there. And then the other thing I want to say, and then I'll shut up, is, you know, we were talking about how good Gunrunner has been doing as a sire. You know, last week he had the first two finishers in the Haskell with Cyberknife and Taba. This week he had, you know, the first, third and fourth horses in the Amsterdam. I love it that Into Mischief had Prank, who was a rising star, ran a 91 buyer. Newgate, who was ran one first time out, ran 80 buyer. And we have Wonder Wheel, who's undefeated in two starts. And it's an Into Mischief. It's almost like Gunrunner had the success and Into Mischief was like, yeah, Gunrunner, you had a really good run, but hold my beer.
For sure. I mean, those are the two hottest sires in America right now, I would say. And just to wrap up this discussion, I think the objective, what we're trying to do with Rising Stars, to me at least, is to predict graded stakes winners. Now, you know, a few people might argue with that. Somebody might say graded stakes performers or black type stakes winners. To me, it's successful if a Rising Star becomes a graded stakes winner. And I think TDN has a pretty good track record with that kind of thing. There are only so many graded stakes winners, although some would say too many, some including us on this show. But, it's one of those things where there's so many factors that I wasn't working this weekend. I would not have made Capture the Flag a Rising Star just because of the time. It was like 106 and something, which was not fast for 5.5 furlongs, but he sure looked good, looked the part, big muscle horse. And like you said, Suge is not necessarily known for having horses cranked up to win 5.5 furlong 2-year-old races first out. But, you know, that's a factor too, is factoring trainers and trainer patterns, like you guys say with John Sheriff's. And it works the other way too, like with Wesley Ward's horses sometimes, like, you know, no disrespect to Wesley, but a lot of those horses that pop and win those by a ton at Keeneland don't necessarily go on to do all that much. You know, he's had some, obviously, like Golden Pal and Lady Aurelia, who have become superstars. And those were horses that we identified early. But there are a lot of them that kind of fizzle out over the summer and never really live up to that big first out win. So that's another thing that in the opposite of the horses who debut a little bit too late for us to want to make them Rising Stars, the really, really early ones in April of the 2-year-old season, we kind of discount some of those as well, because you don't historically get a lot of great horses coming out of those big 2-year-old maiden races really early in the season. But it's an interesting discussion. And, you know, we have debates about them in the TDN Slack and back when we used to be in the office. And, you know, sometimes we vote and sometimes there's a couple say no and then a majority says yes or the other way around. So it's an interesting process and we appreciate that people care. I think sometimes people care a little bit too much and bug us about making Rising Stars, which we honestly really don't like. And we wish people would stop doing that. Unless you want to come write out races with us, you shouldn't have an opinion on who should be a Rising Star. But nevertheless, it is flattering that people really care about that designation. I think it makes us accountable in a way that, because people care about it so much, that we really have a thoughtful discussion and a thoughtful process in terms of making Rising Stars.
Joe, can I ask one question about it? I know that normally I would say the majority of horses that are deemed a Rising Star is usually after their first race. Is there any kind of criteria as far as, like, if a horse runs a really bad race first time out or doesn't hit the board first time out, but then runs really impressively later on, where that would make it a Rising Star? Because, again, you do project it to be a graded stake winner.
It's a good question. And I think that we generally try to just make them in the first or second start, sometimes in the third start. Anything beyond that, even if the horse is crazy impressive, we tend to not make those horses Rising Stars because we want to identify them early on. But I think, if the second race is so impressive, we kind of will disregard what the first race was if it's that impressive. But on the other hand, the first race can be instructive in terms of what to think about the horse after their second race. And Steve Chirac at TDN does a good job. He has his second chances column, which is basically horses who ran really well first out and ran second or third or fourth, and horses to look for next time out. And that's kind of what we look at. Like, I remember the first Rising Star I ever made, and I'm still really proud of this one to this day, was Arrogate. He was the first one that I made the call on. And I remember his first race, he had a troubled trip going 6 furlongs at Los Alamitos and just came flying late and missed and was third. So I had my antennas up for him next time out. And then when he went to the front and won off by like 5.5 lengths, I was like, this horse, I think, is really good. So, if the first race is so bad, but the second race is so good, we can draw a line through the first race. But also in general, we try to look for those horses who maybe had trouble or maybe just got going too late, but galloped out really well in their first race. And then if they can validate that in their second race, we consider that, as criteria, as positive criteria to make them a Rising Star.
Do you get nervous when you make a Rising Star and the next time they run? Are you like nervous as to see how they run? Or you don't care?
No, I'm only nervous when I don't make John Green's horses Rising Stars and then they come back and win graded stakes next year. That's the only time.
Thankfully, it doesn't happen too often for you. You don't have to worry about that too much.
I can think of two off the top of my head, John.
And where did they start? Where did they win?
Coinage won Saratoga, but it was a New York bred race. That's another thing. We factor in the level of competition and the state bred stuff too.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Thank you.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. There were grade one wins from coast to coast for Keeneland September sales grads last Saturday with Jackie's Warrior and the Vanderbilt and American Theorem and the Bing Crosby looked pretty good as well. Also, all five contenders in the Jim Dandy were graduates of the 2020 Keeneland September sale epicenter. But one that impressively was a $260,000 purchase at Keeneland September for Winchell Thoroughbreds. Your next opportunity awaits at this year's Keeneland September sale, which starts Monday, September 12th. Not that far away, less than 6 weeks. So get prepared for that. And Chris McGrath's latest Keeneland Breeder Spotlight, he talks to John O'Meara, who bred several big winners from this summer, headlined by grade three quick call winner Big Invasion. O'Meara acquired the Colts' third dam back in 2000 for $55,000. You can read the full story at the TDN. It's called Invasion, a big tribute to O'Meara. You should always be reading those stories. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
When the thoroughbred world descends upon Lexington this November, there is one place you need to be. The place where history comes alive with every championship victory.
He's authentic indeed!
The place where the future is built with the fall of a gavel. The place that exists to be the heart of this industry. The center of it all. Home to the November Breeding Stock Sale and the 2022 Breeders' Cup, Keeneland.
Maximum Security proves he's the real deal with a gate-to-wire win in the Florida Derby.
Champion three-year-old.
Maximum Security has won the TVG.com Haskell Invitational.
11 triple-digit buyers.
Maximum Security, he smoked them in the cigar mile.
Grade 1 winning four-year-old.
Maximum Security takes them all the way in the TVG Pacific Classic.
Secure your mare's future. Maximum Security.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. Justify added his sixth winner over the weekend with what we just mentioned, new TDN Rising Star Justique. She's our freshman sire's second TDN Rising Star. Plus, she's a half sister to Ashford sire Motown. Coolmore sire American Pharaoh got his fourth grade one winner of the year with American Theorem and the Bing Crosby. American Pharaoh now has more grade one winners in 2022 than any other North American stallion. And Mendelssohn has sired three winners over the past week with Penny Polka at Delaware Park, Miracle at Saratoga, and Quincy Cafe at Laurel. First crop sire now ranks just behind his studmate Justify with five winners already this year. So this week for the Green Group Guest of the Week, we'll talk to David O'Rourke, who is obviously the CEO of the New York Racing Association. A lot of big news coming out of NYRA these days, not just at Saratoga, but with the announcement that Belmont's fall meet is going to be held at the Big A. So we've talked to David before, always a really smart and insightful guy. Let's talk to David O'Rourke. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're thrilled to welcome back to the show, fresh off the Whitney draw, NYRA CEO Dave O'Rourke. Thanks for coming on, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for having me, everyone.
Great to talk to you as always. You know, NYRA made some big news last week announcing that the Belmont Fall Meet will be run at Aqueduct this fall because there's construction going on to have tunnels go to the infield at Belmont. I would talk to you about the Aqueduct thing because I'm such a romantic Aqueduct supporter, but I want to ask about the Belmont infield because that's kind of been one of the big unused spaces in New York racing for a long time. What are the plans? What are the ideas for the infield? Would it be something you only used on Belmont Stakes Day, other festival days? Would there be concerts? What's the idea?
The actual complete plan for the infield, I wouldn't say is totally fleshed out. It's obviously something we would use on big days like Belmont and create like a different experience. But right now, we've, over the last several years, have redone all of our racetracks. Aqueduct is essentially new tracks. Up here in Saratoga, we've touched all of them, including Oklahoma. The Belmont training track was done several years ago, and the main tracks, the main track and the two turf courses at Belmont are kind of due. And we're at the same time, we have our long-term plan to consolidate downstate to one facility, and that facility would be Belmont. So then you have this 50 acres plus in the infield, and really the time is now if you ever want to access it. You wouldn't want to redo these tracks and then cut the tunnel, especially the north side tunnel, which is large. It's essentially a commercial tunnel that you could bring tractor trailer through, and right next to it, a pedestrian tunnel. there's a lot of different things. There's potential for parking. There's potential for community like fields. Like it's massive. Obviously, things like big event days like Belmont and a synthetic surface as well. And that is part of our long-term plan is to put a synthetic surface in there that would help us with winter racing and potentially when we're off the turf. So it's really the first phase of the redevelopment of the racing surfaces at Belmont. And so we'll hopefully get that. Well, we will get that done this fall and we'll be able to be back on them in the spring. And then we'll have the next iteration of what we'll tackle. Will it be the synthetic? Will it be one of the turf courses at some point, the main track as well? It has a clay base. We'd like to make it synonymous with what we've done here at Saratoga and Aqueduct, like an all weather type track. And that's about it. That's what we've got so far.
Hey Dave, thanks for joining us. And it's exciting to talk to you because it's an exciting time for the future of New York racing. You guys have been talking about this for a long time about, you know, what's going to happen with the two tracks, et cetera. And, you know, this obviously was the first step in what I would think is going to be a longer process. Is it pretty much set in stone that Aqueduct's days are numbered? That's my first question. You know, what about where are we 5-6 years from now so far as what racetracks make up the circuit?
Well, I mean, nothing's set in stone until we can actually complete the project, and that would include the funding for the building. But in terms of our strategy and what we're putting forward, for sure. And in 5-6 years from now, if everything goes the way that we would like it to go, we would be racing at Belmont and Saratoga and not at Aqueduct.
Right. And John, if you let me interject, the other question was, and again, I know these sometimes are things are always in motion, but what about the Belmont grandstand? Again, you could always have reserved the right to change your mind, the NYRA board to change their mind. But, you know, are we going to see a new grandstand built, presumably one much smaller than what we have now?
Yeah, that is absolutely the plan. And that's what we've been proposing. Just for some numbers, the grandstand's about 1.3 million square feet. We think something more right size would be more along the lines of 300,000 square feet. And essentially where you have the you know, there's the clubhouse portion, and that's really where it would be. And then you have the grandstand portion, which would be opened up in more green space. And that opens up a lot of possibilities on areas for, you know, what we can do with the turn, in essence, extend the backyard, which now we would also have the infield, which can complement that as well.
And David, last year, you were one of the key presenters in the Jockey Club roundtable discussions. And during that presentation, you talked about integrity, safety, and sustainability of the sport. And I really feel like that NYRA is at the forefront of all of those ideals. Can you give the audience an idea of what things are coming down the pike in the future that will, again, continue to instill integrity, safety, and sustainability?
Well, in terms of integrity, of HISA rolling out, and then the medication should roll out beginning of next year. In terms of, you know, in safety, really, a lot of it starts with the surfaces, and that's one of the you know, the tracks at Belmont are some of the better tracks, but we want to have the best tracks, period. And those turf courses in particular haven't been redone in 50 plus years. It's really a core competency of ours. We have Glenn Kozak, who's our senior VP of capital projects. I mean, I might be biased, but he's the best track person in the country and possibly one of the best in the world. And redoing these Belmont surfaces, we think, is fundamental for one of our core competencies / advantages is just to have the best surfaces. And we've done them all. Now it's time to do Belmont.
I just wanted to follow up on that. Is one of the goals in winterizing Belmont to get the Breeders' Cup again? Because it's been a long time. It's been since 2005. Belmont is obviously one of the core pieces of the fall racing schedule and one of the historic tracks in America. Are you guys looking to get the Breeders' Cup back?
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it a goal. I'd say it's an expectation for sure.
Yep.
That's a solid yes.
Yep. Great. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, sure. Getting back to the redo of Belmont, we've learned and been told that the configuration of the courses is not going to change. So you're still going to have this mile and a half oval, which, you know, obviously for Belmont Stakes works perfectly. But, you know, you can make an argument that it's not the best circumference for day in and day out racing. Was there any thought given to making it a mile and eighth track? Don't think you would even consider a mile. And if not, why not?
There were considerations in terms of just laying out what we could do. A lot of different iterations. One of them included moving the turf course to the outer and then changing the middle course actually into a synthetic. There's a lot to that. There's a lot of tradition. We've had some conversations with our board. We have a planning committee, and it's not an easy decision on that. Now, when we do redo the main surface, the mile and a half, I believe the goal will be to install it in a way where it could be converted to a synthetic at some point in the future. Because we're trying to make decisions where, well, in 20 years, 10, 15 years, we wouldn't want to invest a huge amount of money where you really can't pivot off of it. So I understand exactly that question. It's a tough question. But for now, we're looking at the same configuration and with a synthetic either being a mile and a mile and 16th on the inner.
David, I want to pivot for a second because obviously you've been a mainstay in Naira for years, and again, made them one of the best racing circuits in the world. When you sit back and you look at the calendar of races that come up, is there a specific day that you look at and you're like, I'm really going to enjoy watching that day's card? Is it Belmont Day? Is it Whitney Day? Is it Alabama Day? What's your favorite day in racing for Naira?
That's a really good question. Opening day, Saratoga. Because it's a really busy time of year for us. We go through the Belmont Stakes and then we're coming up here. But I'd say opening day at Saratoga is just, you kick it off and, you know, for the next 40 day or the next 39 after that day, you're the focus of thoroughbred racing in North America. So it's pretty cool. That would be my answer on that.
There's been a lot of discussion recently about the greatest stakes in the stakes calendar and how there's some overlap and some redundancies that are creating a lot of short fields. Like I think about Belmont Day, and in terms of star power, it was everything you could possibly want. It was basically every great horse in America right now, but the fields were 5-6 horses, and that's certainly not unique to New York racing. Santa Anita has had a big problem with that. But I think it's on not only on the American Great Stakes Committee, but on individual tracks and businesses to try to figure out how to best construct that stake schedule. Is that a conversation that you guys have had in terms of trying to space out stakes a little bit more so we have a better betting product, and why or why not?
Yeah, we actually have had the conversation at a kind of a high level. Just prior to, I think, Bill, you had that article on this exact topic, and I agree with that article 100%. So we've had the conversation, and this summer there will be some racing folks, because these are decisions that the racing folks need to make. But what I can, from my perspective, you've got, you know, the fall crop has dropped, the number of graded stakes, period, has not. So is there a dilution effect? And are you seeing that dilution effect in terms of what you're saying? And it's correct. So there's two things. There's spacing and the quantity. And I think both of those things need to be looked at. We don't have a pattern committee, or like we really don't have anyone who lays out that pattern. So I think the dialogue will start. Historically, I don't know if there was enough communication/coordination across some of the major jurisdictions on where we put these races. We shouldn't be trying to cannibalize each other. It's how do we create a series that, you know, ultimately the series ends at the Breeders' Cup. I think there's a lot of work to do here, and I think it'll get better. And I think these races are really good, but it would be a lot better if there's 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm. David, you've been a proponent openly of fixed odds wagering. But as we know now, Naira is not involved in it. You don't send your signal to Monmouth for their fixed odds. You don't have fixed odds for the Naira races, et cetera. But, you know, if you could just sort of say, you know, where is this all headed? Naira is an organization. Is everybody still very much believing that fixed odds are a big part of the future? And what needs to happen so that you guys get involved in the fixed odds wagering?
Yeah, sure. Yes, we do think fixed odds, and specifically the sports books, bring the opportunity to access a massive customer base. And, you know, fixed odds would allow racing to kind of offer some different wagers. We do believe that the paramutual pools are very, very important. And we have to be careful as we add products. So ideally, and I'll go back to answer the question, what we would, Naira would need to actually engage in fixed odds in North America. But our ideally, we'd like to see paramutual picked up by the sports books and then to layer in fixed odds and go from there, rather than go with fixed odds and then try and push paramutual onto those platforms. So our preference is to get paramutual established and then to introduce fixed odds, where you can do a lot of neat stuff with proposition bets, things you can make off the fly. There's certain bets that are hard to do parimutuelly that are much easier to do with fixed. Conversely, there's some value in some of the parimutuel bets, especially like the exotics that I don't think you'll really see replicated on the fixed odds side because of the risk dynamic there. For New York, we've actually have requested to allow our content to go into New Jersey, and you know, on a limited basis, it's really win, place, show, I believe. The issue that we face, and it's actually very, it makes sense. The Interstate Horse Racing Act, there's a stipulation that says that you can cross state lines with racing products as long as the wager is legal in both jurisdictions. At the moment, fixed odds on horse racing is not legal in New York State. So that's what would need to change. We had proposed, I believe Senator Addabbo, I think, had a bill. It didn't go through, but we'll come back to that. I don't really think there's that much pushback against it. There's just been so much changing on the wagering, specifically sports betting landscape in New York. I think we're just got to wait our turn. We'll keep pushing on that, but just that, you know, we do understand that we don't really want to just go out with fixed odds. We want to bring parimutuel first onto these platforms because they may not adopt it if we don't go in that direction.
And this is going to be redundant, but you guys have a big stakes weekend coming up this weekend, where you're giving away, over $2.5 million in purses, keyed with $2 million races. When you get a field like you have in the Whitney with American Revolution and Hot Rod Charlie, Olympia, Life is Good, obviously, you know, where you have so many superstars coming into this race, what's your hope? When you get a race like this, like the Whitney, is it the dead heat? Is it, to have a bigger field? Is it for one of the horses specifically to win? When you look at that field, what is your wish and desire when the race is over?
Well, it's a really good competitive field. That's what you want going into it. And, no, you just want a clean race. And everyone will enjoy it. So I don't really have any expectations. Just want a nice, safe, clean race. Field's competitive, couldn't really ask for more on that one on the from the older division. So we're happy with that.
The field is really befitting of the Whitney, which to me is the best non-Breeders' Cup handicap division race on the calendar. So last question from me, you know, it's similar to the racing calendar question that I just asked. There was a lot of discussion about the spacing of the Triple Crown. You guys came and you in particular came out strongly in favor of the tradition and the traditional spot of the Belmont on the calendar. Obviously, the Preakness is in a tougher spot, being the middle jewel, being 2 weeks after the Derby and 3 weeks before the Belmont. Where do you stand? Where does Naira stand right now on keeping the Belmont where it is? And, you know, if the Preakness did move, would you consider adjusting as well?
It seemed to me, as we were going through that conversation, it seemed a little rushed. Like, if we're going to touch the Triple Crown, I would, from my point of view, would want input across the board and from people like yourselves and really from the public. I don't really feel like anyone feels like it's broken. In terms of the Preakness, you could say they're in a tough spot. Or they're always going to get the Derby winner. Belmont, in a sense, can be one of the best races of the year, or, you know, depending on what happens, maybe we're in a tough spot. But moving something like that, I think, is something that needs to be debated and discussed a lot and not off the cuff. I mean, that was really my point. I don't know if we may be open to it, if that's really where the public and like the stakeholders in the industry want to go. But I don't think it's something that really want, because what could happen is if one person moves, it could kind of create a cascade effect where everyone else has to react. And I'm just hoping that that's not the way it would play out.
All right, Dave, thank you so much for coming on. We know you're a busy guy. Saratoga is going better than ever. Somehow, every year it gets better. Thanks for the time, Dave.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Dave O'Rourke will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
Accelerate, a five-time grade one winner with over $6 million in earnings. In 2018 alone, he won the Santa Anita Handicap, the Gold Cup, the Pacific Classic by a record-setting 12 and a half lengths, the Awesome Again, and bested a world-class field in the Breeders' Cup Classic. A grandson of legendary Lane's End stallion Smart Strike, Accelerate stands to continue his grandsire's legacy at Lane's End.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Lane's End. This week's Lane's End Stallion of the Week is Catalina Cruiser, who was one of my favorites when he was running. He was represented this year by his first crop of yearlings. Son of Eugene Rags had five yearlings sell at the Facing Tip in July sale, headlined by a $100,000 colt out of She's Trouble. He's got four yearlings selling next week at the Saratoga sale, including the half-brother to recent Grade 3 Monmouth Oaks winner, Shahama, and he'll be represented by another five yearlings at the Facing Tipton New York Bred Sale, so get in early on those Catalina Cruisers because I think they're going to blow up once they hit the track. All right, so I was on vacation last week, and honestly, it was a pleasure with all the Heisa legal bullshit going on not to have to pay attention to it. I kind of got a little bit of a refresher this morning. I was reading about the injunction that's happening in West Virginia and Texas, and now there's jockeys that are suing and Jockeys Guild is suing. So this is why we have Bill Finley here. He's the reporter. He has to pay attention to this stuff. Bill, what should I care about? And what are some of what's some of the fallout of the past week's legal back and forth?
Well, Joe, thanks for that introduction, but I'm trying as hard as I can not to pay attention to this because it just gives you a headache.
Yeah.
Is all it does. And, honestly, T.D. Thornton's done a great job with this. We've been doing the coverage together, but I mean, there's so many lawsuits out there right now. I've lost track. Honestly, of the latest though, however, was one where the Jockeys Guild got three jockeys to individually sue Heisa. Drayden Van Dyke is one of them. And what they're obviously trying to do here is backing up a little bit. We had the successful injunction granted in the motion filed by the Jockeys Guild, West Virginia and Louisiana. So Heisa rules are not in effect in those two states. The Jockeys Guild wants the Heisa rules to not be in effect anywhere pending the outcome of further court cases. So look, I mean, unless you're some sort of legal nerd who loves getting into the deep dive into these things, I mean, you almost can't even, your head wants to explode. But I mean, I think the bigger picture, Joe, is that this is just a mess at this point. And it's so much a mess that I don't know what's up, what's going in each direction. And, I don't get it in the sense that, why is there so much vitriol out there against this thing? And, the name of the group and the act speaks for itself, integrity and safety. They're trying to make the game safer. And they're trying to, make it more honest. And they're trying to do that under one central authority. And who could be against that? It's pointed out that they're like the jockeys are against this. And there's several provisions in Heisa that make things better for the jockeys so far as protocols tracks have to take to look after their health and safety. So, I got to think that this is going to just, I don't know where Heisa goes from here until all these lawsuits are settled. And then the other thing, too, is, the thing's been in effect for over a month now. Have anybody noticed any major changes, any disruptions to racing? These guys come out and say, we'll be irreparably harmed by Heisa. It's going to, but what it is, this is horse racing. You try to get together as an industry and do something. And then it just blows up on you. And I can't say I'm surprised.
John?
I believe me, this is so above my pay grade. I wish I could pretend that I even understood all the legal maturations going on with this. I just sit and every day I read the articles, you know, by Bill and TD, and I thank the Lord that they are able to disseminate it and break it down to somebody at my level, because it spins my head. And I'm in a family of, you know, I have seven cousins and six of them are attorneys. So the legal stuff I should be able to understand, but this is just, it's so much. And I think so much of it is freaking nonsensical, because everyone and their brother was, you know, railing over the fact that we needed to have some kind of unified, you know, rulemaking and stuff like that. And now they're trying to break it down to where if certain specific jockeys are in the suit, then they, if they win, then they are going to be, you know, outside the scope of HISA. So that means that like one of the jockeys who is named as a in the lawsuit, if he wins, then he's allowed to beat the crap out of a horse down the stretch, but all the other jockeys can only do it in accordance with HISA rules. Like, it doesn't make any sense. I'm like so beside myself. That's why I wasn't even going to comment, because it's so freaking stupid.
Yep. I mean, it's like Bill is saying, like, what is the injury that has been done so far by HISA in the month that it's been in effect? Like, what is the great injustice that's been done to jockeys or to trainers? Like, literally, like, all I've heard is a registration drive. We haven't had horses scratched, which was a concern. And I just think what happens, and, you know, this happens in the legal world, I think, when there's like one entity that a lot of people are trying to get out from under, is lawyers and plaintiffs smell blood in the water. And now that we've got that injunction, like you were saying, Bill, in West Virginia and Louisiana, I just think that it's going to give free rein to everybody who has any kind of grievance or perceived grievance whatsoever to jump in and try to say, well, the rule shouldn't apply to me now because of this, this, and this. And again, like I feel like John a little bit, where it's like above my pay grade, and it's not. I can't break down the individual letter of the law that HISA has, and I'm not saying that there aren't, you know, impositions, and I think especially veterinarians are kind of in a tough spot now with HISA, you know, potentially being up their ass about, you know, whatever treatments they're giving. And you know, I think you need to have people who really know equine veterinary practices to kind of work hand in hand with the vets. And I think that that's one of the things that is a little bit of a cumbersome factor right now. But in terms of like the jockeys and the trainers, like, how has, you know, please, and this is a legitimate question, this isn't a rhetorical or a sarcastic question, let me know, how has your life significantly changed in the past month that HISA has been in effect? And I can't imagine that it's really disrupting your business that much. And I think, like I said, it's just, you know, people don't want, so a lot of people do not want this overarching body, you know, handling their sport or, you know, their state, and they just will find any kind of legal justification to try to sue to get out from up under it. And it's just, it's tiresome. And it the more this goes on, the more lawsuits we get like this, the more I'm just tempted to throw my hands up and be like, well, we tried, you know, we got this bill passed, and we got some people who, you know, theoretically have the best interests of racing trying to unify everything in this sport, which I think we all agree desperately needs unification, and yet we can't just let it play out. And this would be a different story if it had been going on for a year and there were all these problems and all these fires to put out. Then it's one thing, but we're a month into this and already people can't stand it, and they're trying to flip it over. I just don't get it. How in this industry we talk a good game about getting everything under one roof, and then once we try to do it, there are 5,000 splinter groups who are like, I don't want that, so I'm going to do what I can to stop it.
And Joe, let me just add one more thing that is infuriating to me about this. So, you know, people read through the rules and immediately started complaining about medication rules and you know, they don't know what they're talking about and they should have horsemen in there. And I understand that they should have trainers involved in, and veterinarians for that matter, involved in the rulemaking, because ultimately they are going to be the stewards that are going to have to carry out the rules, and they're going to know what things can and can't work. Okay. But there was an outcry about, you know, the shoeing issues, and that, you know, that they were wrong and that they needed to be updated. Now, we've had these rules in place since July 1st. It is now August 3rd. Let's say it's a month. So once the outcry came out about the shoeing issues and everything like that, Heise et al. Brought together trainers and blacksmith and said, what should the rule be, basically? I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but basically they're like, what should the rules be? They updated the rules and now new rules are in effect, which is great. I heard people complaining about, well, you know, look, the rules are so bad that they're changing them on the fly. No, they're actually being proactive. When was the last time a government entity, for God's sake, came in and said, give us your thoughts? And within a month, they changed the rules to make it to exactly the way people want it. So you can't have it both ways, people. You can't have it where, you know, oh, I don't want to be under the rules and these are so, you know, and they're so strict and blah, blah, blah. And then when they bring you in and say, go ahead and let's talk about it and how should we make this change and better? Then they say, oh, well, look, they screwed it up because it should have been right from the first way. It's just maddening. People are so free. People are beautiful. They always want to complain. And look, I understand if people want to complain about Bill Finley's writing, I get it. I'll jump in there. They want to complain that Joe Bianco should never take a vacation because the show sucks without him. I get it. I understand. But for God's sake, man, let's all start rowing in the same direction so we can make this industry better and actually around for another decade or two.
But you know what? And just like Joe said, here's the thing. And I'd like to rephrase. I genuinely don't understand what people are upset about, or so upset about, upset to the point where there's like, it's almost like, you know, hatred, like right. Anger and nastiness. And, you know, if they have any legitimate beefs, maybe they do, they have done a very poor job of articulating them.
Yeah. And John, you know, makes a great point is that you complain that these rules are being sent down from on high and you have no input, and then you have input and you use the input and the changing of the rules to point to how it's a slipshod system and there's no direction whatsoever. That's, you know, that's one thing you cannot say is I think the people who are in charge of Heise have done a good job of listening and adapting because they know that this isn't, you know, there's not necessarily going to be a quick one size fits all fix to all of these issues. And it's just ridiculous that you've been heard. You've been heard multiple times. Maybe not everything is right just the way you want it to be, but you can't complain both ways that you're being dictated to. And then when you're listened to, well, they're changing the rules. So they really had no idea what they were doing in the first place. Like it's just, you want it both ways and you don't want this thing and you'll find any kind of justification to try to get away from it. That's just what it seems like. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Kentucky Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders. Recent Grade 1 winning Kentucky breds include Haskell winner, Cyberknife, Dominant, CCA Oaks, Victorious Nest, Alfred G. Vanderbilt winner and champion, Jackie's Warrior, and Bing Crosby victor, American Theorem. You can look for your next Kentucky bred next week at the Facing Tipton Saratoga sale. And just around the corner is that Kentucky Downs meet where there's going to be a ton of money up for grabs, but especially for Kentucky breds. We'll be right back after this message from the KTOB.
With some of the fullest fields in the country and quality racing year-round, there's never been a better time to reap the rewards of breeding and racing in Kentucky. Purse money in Kentucky is at an all-time high, as is average purse per race, outpacing California, Florida, and New York. Kentucky breds. Breed them. Raise them. Race them. We all win.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. This week's XBTV workout of the week is Charge It. We worked 4 furlongs and 49.06 at Saratoga on Saturday, which you can see right now. If you're watching the video version of this podcast, the Todd Pletcher-trained son of Tappet was last seen, obviously winning by 23 lengths in the Grade 3 Dwyer Stakes. He's now preparing for a bid in the Travers. And I think those works are going to be especially important for him if you're handicapping because he isn't running between the Dwyer and the Travers. So you really need to get as much intel as you can from those workouts because he's not going to have that other race to see if he can back that up, because that's the question. Because if he runs back to that race and the Travers stretches out to a mile a quarter and all that, he's going to win. You know, as much as we loved Epicenter over the weekend and he was great, Charge It runs back to that race, he's going to win the Travers and he's going to be the leading three-year-old coming out of that race. But there's a lot to be determined between now and then. And a lot of it is going to be based on those workouts. So go to xbtv.com. You can check those out and check out all those two-year-old works as well. You can see those rising stars before they become rising stars and then yell at us when they don't become rising stars.
All right, so here's this week's weekend preview. Got a lot of good action, both at Del Mar and Saratoga, even a little at West Virginia, which is now no longer under the purview of Heise. I'm sure there'll be a huge, huge difference in the racing and the jockeying this Saturday at West Virginia, at Mountaineer, when they have the West Virginia Derby and the Grade 3 West Virginia Governor Stakes and a bunch of other stakes named after government officials for some reason in West Virginia. But the big race that we're all going to have our eyes on, I'm going to do a Better Things later today previewing it with my new Breeders' Cup sponsorship, is the Whitney, the $1 million Whitney. It's a win and you're in for the Breeders' Cup Classic. And it's a race we always look forward to every year. To me, it's pretty clearly the second most important race of the meet at Saratoga. And I think arguably one of if not the best non-Breeders' Cup handicap division race every single year. I think it's probable that we're only going to get it 5 or 6 horses, but I think we're going to get a really star-studded field, headed, of course, by Life is Good and Olympiad. We're waiting for these two to go at it. Life is Good, obviously, is one of the most brilliant horses we've seen, not just this year, but in several years. But Olympiad is more proven. Even though Life is Good had that race in the Pegasus, I do think that Olympiad is a better two-turn horse. I think he's going to give him a real run for his money. Obviously, we don't have the PPs yet, but a lot is going to be determined based on how loose Life is Good gets on the lead, because I could easily see him pulling a Knicks Go last year and just popping out to the front, coming a little bit wide off the turn and finishing off strong in the stretch. I do think it's a better field this year than last year in the Whitney. We might also have American Revolution, who's another nice Todd Pletcher horse, who was second to Olympiad, and the Stephen Foster, as well as Hot Rod Charlie, who was upset last out at Monmouth, but is obviously still a very nice four-year-old. Happy Zaver and Zoomer for Mark Cassio, the other ones that I'm seeing on the probables. A couple other races to talk about, but let's get some thoughts on the Whitney from Bill and John.
Yeah, I mean, one of the themes of the Saratoga meet and Naira racing in general is these small fields and stakes races. But you know what? If you have a small field, it makes up a big difference, and it makes things so much more palatable if you have all these big stars in these races. And that's what we're getting here. You know, Life is Good will be the favorite. Will you agree, Joe? Life is Good will be the favorite over Olympia?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Sure. He'll be the favorite in there, but you know, I'm more interested in what Olympiad does, because he's the horse, more so than anybody else in here, where we're going to find out something about him. And as great as he has been, and he has been very good, he's never won a Grade One race, and he's only run in one Grade One his entire career, which is the Cigar Mile last year, where he ran fourth. So, you know, Bill Mott's putting him in the spot where he belongs, and he's going to get a test. And, you know, come late Saturday afternoon, early evening, you know, we're going to have a lot of questions answered about him, and, you know, maybe some questions answered as well about Life is Good, because, you know, as good as he's been, this is the best field he's ever faced. You know, even though he beat Knicks Go in the Pegasus, I think the overall depth of this field probably tops the Pegasus. So it's going to be a really exciting race. Hot Rod Charlie is interesting to me too. I mean, this is a horse that's always kind of flown under the radar, and, you know, it's hard to get excited about a horse that got beaten in the Grade 3 Salvatore Mile at Monmouth, but he's a better horse than that. I'm sure that Doug O'Neill didn't have him all cranked up for that. But yeah, it should be you know, a really, really good race. And all along, I think we've been asking the question, how good is Olympiad? We're going to get an answer.
Yeah, how good is this race potentially from a field standpoint that we're talking about Hot Rod Charlie, who all he did was he's made $5 million and basically has danced every dance. He's the fourth horse we're talking about in a 6-horse field, you know, a projected 6-horse field. That's how good of an overall group this is. All the current probables in the race, their last race either finished first or second. So they're all coming in. Not only are the good horses really good horses, but they're all coming in on an upswing where either they finished first or second in their respective previous race. That's why you have these, you know, races like this. This is a legitimate Grade One. This is a race that, you know, that we have on our calendar that every year, you know, people are pointing towards, not only because of this, of the prestige and stature of the Whitney itself and the fact that it's a Grade One at Saratoga, but it's a win you're in. I mean, if you win this race, it doesn't matter what you do from now until November. You are automatically given a berth in the Breeders' Cup Classic in the richest race here in the States. So to me, this is going to be a small field, but a very powerful field top to bottom. And it's going to be a great betting race, even though it's only six horses. And Joe, I know you're going to talk about this in your show, so we'll cross-pollinate a little bit about that. I'd be interested to see the show and listen to what you're going to say about Hot Rod Charlie, Olympiad, Life is Good, American Revolution. And then, oh, by the way, Pletcher also has Happy Saver, who finished second in the Met Mile, and Zoomer, who, is going to be the long shot in the race, but, certainly is, is an interesting claim by Gary Barber and trained by Hall of Famer Mark Cassie. So it is top to bottom going to be a really interesting race to handicap and a really interesting race to watch.
Well, and like we were saying before, I think we're going to have more answers after this race about the horse of the year discussion. And I Olympiad is, he's been on the streak, but he doesn't have that grade one win. He needs that grade one win, I think, to get onto the podium for horse of the year, especially if he beats Life is Good, who I think a lot of people consider, maybe other than Flightline, pound for pound, the best horse in the country. And of course, Life is Good does have the grade one win from the Pegasus, but then he disappointed a little bit in the Dubai World Cup and then won a grade two last time out. So there's still work to be done for everybody in this race, especially the top contenders, to try to, get into that discussion for the top older male or horse of the year. But that's not the only grade one race at Saratoga this week, this Saturday. We want to mention also the Saratoga Derby, which is a race that's near and dear to John's heart, with Threat of Blue having won it a couple of years ago. Yeah. So we looks like we're going to have an 8 or 9 horse field in there. Annapolis for Todd Pletcher is really interesting. I think he might be the best 3-year-old turf horse in the country. Classic Causeway, after his upset win in the Belmont Derby, is going to run back in there. Emmanuel, think theoretically, is going to run this time and maybe be a fly in the ointment for Classic Causeway. Of course, my boy Psydog for Graham Motion is going to be in there too. We have the Saratoga Oaks on Sunday, but we also have the Test Stakes, the grade one Longines Test this Saturday, which is obviously a pretty classic Philly, 3-year-old Philly sprint race that it's, to me, the Test is one of those races that stamps who the best 3-year-old Philly is in the country at a mile or shorter. And we're going to have a good field. We've got Tarabi, who won on opening weekend for Cherie DeVoe, Hot Peppers, who's become a nice horse for Rudy Rodriguez, a private purchase, I believe. Matt Araya, who I think is that horse right now, who's the standard bearer in that 3-year-old Philly sprint division for Brad Cox. A couple other nice horses in there as well. So we've got a lot to look forward to. Also the Glens Falls, Warlike Goddess, who we all extolled last year, is a really, really nice turf filly marathoner. She's going to defend her title in the Glens Falls. We also have the Clement Hirsch, which is a grade one, also a Breeders' Cup winning year in on Saturday at Del Mar. And then Sunday, we got the Saratoga Oaks. We also have the Adirondack Stakes. We also have the La Jolla for 3-year-old turf horses at Del Mar. So a lot of good action this weekend, but I think we're all eyes are going to be on the Whitney. It's going to be the type of race you set an alarm for if you're out at the beach or something. I want to watch the Whitney live because there's going to be a lot of fallout from that in terms of who we analyze as the top of those handicapping older male and horse of the year divisions for the rest of the year. Any other thoughts, guys, on any other races from this weekend?
Yeah, I do. Just on one more race, and that's the Grade Two Hall of Fame. For the 3-year-olds that are going to run, a mile on the inner turf course at Saratoga. In that race, you have Wit, who I think is maybe avoiding Jack Christopher and Jackie's Warrior a little bit in the sprints and trying not only the turf for the first time, but also going around two turns for the first time. You have Wow What a Summer, who won the Grade Two Penn Mile at 80-1 a couple races ago, and he's in this race. Stolen Base, who won the American Turf, grade two. And then on the outside is the outside, not outside looking in, but the outside post position is Tis the Bomb, who's returning to the turf after trying to make it in the Derby campaign and run on the Poly and run in the Kentucky Derby. And oh, by the way, all he's done is, run the turf four times. He's got two wins and a second, including the grade two Bourbon. So, to me, that's going to be an interesting betting race also, because you have, 9 entries, 66 career starts between, all 9 entries. But only one of them has ever set foot on the turf at Saratoga. So they're all trying something new, which is going to be really interesting to see just how this all plays out.
Thanks to John for bringing that up, because there are two really interesting races on Friday, two great stakes races, the Hall of Fame. Obviously, the Hall of Fame induction ceremony is Friday morning. If you're there, if you're in Saratoga, go check it out. Tom Durkin is going to be the MC. That alone is worth the price of admission, which I believe is $0. So that, you know, that's, you can't beat that. Go to the Hall of Fame and the Facing Tippett Sales Pavilion for free and listen to Tom Durkin induct some people into the Hall of Fame. But also in the Troy Stakes, the Grade 3 Troy is on Friday. We have the return of Golden Pal, who is obviously the best turf sprinter in America. You know, he was not good in the King Stand, obviously, but I think a lot of that was circumstantial. He broke slowly, had to rush up on the pace, and just, you know, for whatever reason, I know he was second in the Norfolk as a two-year-old. He just seems to like the American turf courses better than the European turf courses, because he wasn't very good in the Wooten Bassett Nunthorpe last year at York either. But in a stateside, he is 6-for-7. His only loss in America came in his debut when he was on the dirt. He's 6-for-6 in America on turf. Tough to be better than that. And I think we're going to be looking for kind of a reprisal of his quick call win last year, which, you know, that was his seasonal debut. This is his third start of the year, but he's coming back to America. So another chance for him to reestablish himself as what he is, which is the best turf sprinter we have on this continent. So yeah, Friday, Hall of Fame, Troy, Saturday, Whitney Day at Saratoga, and also the Clement Hirsch. And then Sunday, we've got the Saratoga Oaks. So big, nice 3-day weekend of racing. We'll break it down next week, obviously, here on the Writers' Room. The TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost. We're trying to do it on your own. You can learn more at westpointtb.com. West Point had two winners this week. First with B-Dog, who I assume is named after the great Philadelphia Eagles safety Brian Dawkins. B-Dog got back to his winning ways in an allowance at Ellis Park last Friday. If you remember, he had a big win at Keeneland earlier this year. And then on Tuesday, Colonial Downs County Final, it was a purchase last year for West Point, got the win for trainer Steve Asmussen. West Point kicks off their week of racing at Saratoga on Friday with Sequist. Dallas Stewart trained filly, ran in last year's Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies, now takes on Allowance Company in race 5 on Friday. So best of luck to all the partners this weekend at West Point. We'll be right back with this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse, every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
The TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy graduates sharp as a tack. How about the start that Sharp as Tech is off to as a freshman sire? He just won his second juvenile start in the Tyro Stakes at Monmouth for Doug O'Neill. Really romped in there. He'll be pointing toward the $500,000 juvenile sprint at Kentucky Downs on September 8th. While his yearling half-sister prepares to sell with Legacy at Keeneland in September, so obviously a big catalog update with Sharp as Attack becoming a stakes winner in the Tyro, and you know, half-sister available with Tommy and Wendy. They're going to take care of you. Go see them. It's busy season for them, but they're a small outfit that gives everybody individual attention, and they do a great job, obviously, with all the money that their grads have earned. This week's Remy cartoon is kind of, you know, a little bit of a throwback to what we were talking about earlier about how it's very hard for us to even agree on the basic things in racing. Sometimes we do have the Jockey Club Roundtable coming up. This is a racing roundtable conference in the cartoon where I think theoretically we all have an agreement on what a horse is, how to define a horse. If we can just start there and then branch off from that, I think that's a good first step
to getting some agreement and some cooperation in horse racing. Okay, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. Don't forget, this November, Keeneland is the place to be, with the Breeders' Cup World Championships followed directly for the Keeneland November sale. You can learn more at november.keeneland.com. It was good to be back with you guys, Bill and John. Missed you guys last week. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, David O'Rourke, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week.